kia ora Sonia, kia ora tātou, ko Kiko e te maunga, ko Waikato te awa, ko Bombay te waka, ko Ngāti Pākehā te iwi, ko Ngāi te Tiriti te iwi hoki. Nō reira, tēnā koutou katoa, ngā mihi ki te tangata whenua o konei, ki ngā rangatira, ki ngā tangata o konei, tēnā tātou katoa. I should add a small disclaimer, as is possibly expected for a talk of this kind, that these are my personal views, to the extent I express my personal views today, and are not those of the Crown or my employer, the Ministry of Justice. My question today, my key question is, what contribution have treaty settlements made to a wider national conversation on history, identity and justice in Aotearoa New Zealand? And my problem definition, if one answer to that question is that New Zealanders still generally don't understand treaty settlements, still don't have a base level of understanding of their history, is that a problem for New Zealand society in a post-settlement future? I begin with a story that some of you may recognise. On a balmy spring day in 1856, a certain Uramu Tamihana, son of the great Waikato chief Te Waharoa, walked into the governor's office at Auckland. On his entering the foyer, he greeted the desk attendant, informing him of his name and tribe, Ngāti Hauā of the Waikato Confederation. A message was instantly dispatched to the governor's EA. Governor Gore Brown was immediately informed of Tamihana's arrival, and the governor sallied forth along the corridor into the foyer, greeting the rangatira. "Sir William, come along, my good man. I must say, the reports of your accomplishments at Peria are amazing. Almost full literacy among your children, a flourishing grain enterprise, a post office, church, the lot. And this proposal for new laws, superlative, etc., etc." Now, in case you hadn't spotted it, this is more, I trust, like a 2015 scenario. Because what actually happened in 1856 was that Tamihana did not get an audience with Gore Brown after waiting several hours one day and several hours the next, and watching various Europeans being admitted. And according to missionary Benjamin Ashwell, Tamihana reacted to this rebuff. He said, apparently, "Then I said to myself, we are treated as dogs, I will not go again. I then went to Māngere and I said to Portatau, go back to Waikato and let us consider some tikanga for ourselves." Now, historians have attributed some significance to this moment, for Tamihana, of course, became the king maker, anointing the first Māori king, Portatau Te Whiriwhiri. And so my imagined counterfactual is really a metaphor for the way in which treaty settlements are reversing the lack of recognition historically of chiefly status, including the authority to speak for the interests of a tribal group. What does this transformation look like? One example is the relationship agreements between post-settlement governance entities, or PSGEs, and local government, and between PSGEs and Crown agencies, such as the Department of Conservation, that are giving hapū iwi greater recognition in resource management processes and the management of Crown conservation estate. And in some cases, such as Te Uruwera, iwi have obtained an equal seat at the governance management table, with representatives of government. It could be argued that we have moved from a biculturalism framework of the 1980s, admittedly with some devolution of social services to iwi providers, to an age of co-governance and co-management. From an era where the focus was on Māori expressing unique cultural values and social objectives within a single citizenship framework, an Article 3 framework, let's say, to an era where we are reinvigorating Article 2 rights, effectively reconstituting or recognising tribal authority within state structures. And in a longer view of the colonial story, we are reversing the individualising tendencies and effects of Crown policy towards Māori, which fragmented the collectivities we call tribes, hapū and iwi. And this, I think, is a significant shift. And I've omitted to show you that slide, which went with my opening story. What about the wider national conversation on history, identity and justice? Because I think while treaty settlements are making a real contribution to restoring the Crown Māori relationship, restoring to iwi an economic base, it seems doubtful whether settlements and the historical accounts and apologies undergirding them have contributed much to public discourse on or understanding of our past. Because while settlements aspects of settlements occasionally catch the headlines, the historical narratives fly under the radar. And this results in a mismatch between what settlements are doing and public understanding of them. Historian and former parliamentary political advisor Bernard Cadogan recently gave a paper at the Stout Centre that spoke of treaty settlements as akin to a ritual dance or drama between the Crown and Māori that the wider public does not participate in and doesn't understand. And Danielle Salamasia and Joanna Kidman, in a 2012 article in the Journal of the Polynesian Society, argued to the same effect, that the apologies contained in treaty settlements were not, as they say, embedded in the nation's identity, or that the institutionalisation of Crown apologies to New Zealand Māori has led to a certain alienation of these apologies from broader Pākehā society. And they say that this disconnection between the justice and reconciliation process and society has failed to have much impact on the development of new memory regimes that incorporate Māori narratives of dispossession into the nation's memory of itself. So this issue that Kidman and Salamasia articulate can be expressed as a problem of collective memory, which French philosopher Paul Ricoeur defines as a type of familial discourse that accounts for a group's past, whether that group be a family, tribe or nation. And individual memories, of course, take shape against the backdrop of this collective memory. And Ricoeur thought that the task of doing historical research and writing was to support, correct and sometimes refute collective memory. And I think when we look at treaty discourse over the last 20 to 30 years, this gives us some indication of where Aotearoa New Zealand's collective memory is at. What I want to do is look at the discourse briefly as it was in 1990, before outlining two texts from 2005 and one from 2014. And my focus is, to put it crudely, on the majority discourse or Pākehā discourse. In 1990, Andrew Sharp's, I think, masterful account of 1970s, 80s treaty discourse was published, A Justice in the Māori. I was only born in 1978, the year the Bastion Point occupation was ended, so all of this stuff is a matter of history for me, not memory. Sharp's account shows how strident and heated many of the 80s debates were. A couple of examples for you. In 1987, members of the group Te Ahi Kā, including Te Atarita Poananga, visited Fiji and, as Sharp says, amidst great publicity, proclaimed their support for the revolution there, in which over half the population of continental Indian descent had been stripped of political rights by an Aboriginal movement claiming permanent hegemony. Almost at the other end of the spectrum, by the mid-1980s, Geoff McDonald, a right-wing Australian commentator, was speaking, as Sharp summarises it, of a communist-driven plot to destroy New Zealand by means of fomenting racial and ethnic disaffection. Now, these somewhat incendiary comments interesting gauges on how far or far out the discourse went. But I think it's the more conceptual issues in Sharpe's book that take us further in understanding the discourse and its evolutions down to today. And I've identified three issues in this discourse. One is that the public debate about Māori claims for justice in the 1980s was as much about claims against the Pākehā as against the government of New Zealand or the Crown. And this contrasts with the Treaty Settlements framework, which is based on the Crown and right of New Zealand taking responsibility for the actions of its servants and its political constituents through time. I'm raising that issue today, but I'm not exploring that one. The second issue is the idea that Māori claims were based on articulating a new or different history of Aotearoa than the received orthodoxies of New Zealand history. And a related idea that New Zealanders did not know their history anyway, what Sharpe calls the educational problem, or we might call it the civics problem, vividly expressed in the view that the treaty was a Māori thing. And thirdly, the rejection by many Pākehā of the validity of Māori group rights, or special ethnicity-based rights, on the basis that there was no valid distinction to be made between Māori and Pākehā, that only individuals counted in terms of state law and government. And Sharpe referred to post-World War II politicians employing Hobson's He Iwi Ko Tahi Tātou, now we are all one people. And that was, of course, to make the point that New Zealand was not just one state, but one nation or nationality. And of course, some New Zealanders saw treaty settlements and Māori group recognition by the state as an affront to our democratic way of life, seen perhaps most clearly in recent times in Don Brash's One Law for All speech and Trevor Mallard's We Are All New Zealanders Now speech, both in 2004. And I want to suggest that although public debate on the treaty and treaty settlements has dampened down over the last decade, the evidence of more recent discourse demonstrates that we're still kind of bouncing around between these poles. At one end, sort of dispute over little understood histories. At the other end, confusion about what all this sort of Māori group stuff means in terms of our democratic institutions. Jumping to 2005, a book which I think is a great book by Pat Sneddon called Pākehā and the Treaty, Why It's Our Treaty Too. This is a hopeful perspective on how Aotearoa New Zealand can inhabit a treaty-inspired future, or an Article 2 future. Sneddon writes about his close involvement with Ngāti Whātua o Ōrākei and collaborative Māori health ventures, showing how a genuine treaty partnership is possible. And his homily on the Pākehā relationship with the beach is a beautiful piece of Kiwi prose, injected into the foreshore and seabed debate of 2004-5, no less. He articulates carefully the way Pākehā cultural identity was challenged by the foreshore debates, while describing the Māori collective imperatives. And as he does throughout the book about other matters, he expresses disappointment that the foreshore moment did not become a breakthrough moment in our cross-cultural relationships because it was not accompanied by sufficient cultural self-reflection and knowledge of the historical drivers. My next text is David Slack's book, also in 2005, rather provocatively titled Civil War and Other Optimistic Predictions, which was taken from the evidence of Hāmi Piripi before the Foreshore Committee, which one of the New Zealand newspapers picked up on, as the press is wont to do. I think this is a great book too because he's gone to the effort of going out and getting interesting interviews from I think, a reasonably informed commentariat, although a range of views are expressed. The likes of Stephen Franks, Chris Trotter, Andrew Sharp appears in there, and also Bill Oliver. And it does demonstrate how intense those 2004 debates were. And sometimes, even though it's only 10 years ago, it does feel like a different country, whether it is or not, as a moot point. I think possibly the best thing about this book is the little future predictions that Sharp imagines at the start of each chapter. I just thought I'd read one of them for you, because I quite like it. 6 February 2035, Wellington. The mood was jubilant today for the first sitting of the Māori Parliament. In contrast to the 17 days of inauguration ceremonies, today's business was brisk, with only a few formalities preceding the inaugural debate. A bill to ratify the 8th and final Tainui settlement had its first reading, as did one redrawing the jurisdiction boundaries for the Māori District Courts. The self-styled Thorndon Six, who have maintained a protest vigil in the trees of Parliament grounds for 16 months, continue to express their opposition to separatist politics. The Six, the last remaining members of the ACT political party, which enjoyed a brief flurry of support at the turn of the last century, expressed their determination to remain in the trees until democracy was restored to the voters of New Zealand. Now, the Pākehā collective memory, or I would suggest memory loss about our history, comes into play with this type of imagining. Because, for example, we have had Māori parliaments before, such as this one in the Wairarapa in the 1890s, and we still have Māori parliaments. The one at the top, which is obscured, is one of the Kingitanga parliaments from the 19th century, and that's the Ngāti Hauā deed signing. I'll leave David Slack and briefly go on to Gareth Morgan and Susan Guthrie's very recent Are We There Yet? The Future of the Treaty of Waitangi, which I think is a fascinating attempt to make treaty issues intelligible to the wider public. It draws on an international sort of discourse, sort of philosophical, political science discourse around the governance of plural societies, citing Amartya Sen and Will Kimlicka and people like that. Morgan and Guthrie argue that the treaty is doing too much work. All issues apart from Māori rights and natural resources and taonga, or cultural treasures, should be removed from the Waitangi Tribunal and heard elsewhere. They suggest using citizens' assemblies. They say that the public needs to participate in these debates, which are essentially constitutional in nature. And this is a kind of typical quote. Reading about it after the event in 1,000-page plus tribunal reports is not the way this debate should proceed. So, in summing up, because I think I'm out of time, I think we still have a history problem in Aotearoa, New Zealand, which could be described as a loss of collective memory, particularly about our 19th century settlement past. We're much stronger, of course, on things like Anzac, although there's a lot could be said about that. And we also have an issue with understanding our democratic institutions, which I think is could be expressed as a civics problem. I think it's also the case, though, that we have matured somewhat over the last 20 to 30 years, and I think books like Seddon's and Slack's reveal that shift. I'd just like to play a very small, if you'll just bear with me, little... Where is it? A very small segment of a talk that Tamaiti no less gave to a TEDx conference in Auckland recently.
So after 120 years of struggle, So after 120 years of trouble, of fighting for the Mana or Tuboi. We finally got respect and understanding from the crowd. We got this.
The crowd unreservedly apologizes for not having honored its obligations to Tuboi under Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and profoundly regrets its failure to appropriately acknowledge and respect Te Mana Motuhake o Tuboi for many generations.
That was a nice way to finish. And it's a great talk that you should all go and watch.
And I wonder whether it's a loss of collective memory or that the collective memory was never actually gained. Mm. You know, that understanding was never actually there. And we've only now, as you say, portions of European New Zealand society are gaining it through the treaty processes, etc. But many have never had it. And but I totally agree with your overall conclusion, but I just wonder whether, just in my own research, I don't see much evidence of there ever being an understanding of it from the Pākehā perspective anyway.
Yeah, I think it depends on what your lens is. I think it's more that the Māori narratives of dispossession have never been worked into, you know, that they weren't worked into those older sort of national histories. You know, what recent historians have talked about is the Wakefield tradition, or the Reevesian tradition, you know, the Better Britain tradition. I mean, that's, you could say that those are types of collective memory, admittedly sort of very loose ones, but there's possibly not much room in those for all these Māori narratives, because the Māori narratives which result from colonisation are almost kind of irrelevant to those, I think. Anyway, that's one thought I've got on that.
But what about the term of the Māori Pākehā the 19th century, when we had those collaborations that happened between people like Abidong and Nata, Taumahiroa, and key politicians, and, you know, you've got a kind of artistic motifs emerging in some public architecture where you get those motifs. It's very decorative, and the scholarship of people like Nelson Best, James Cowan, I mean, a lot of that's quite populist, and millions of Europe and people like that. At that time there was, I think, some sort of intellectual, some kind of populist effort to come to grips with what had happened in the previous century, but so something was going on in that era, was provoked by some really strong, eloquent Māori leaders, but quite strong and powerful responses as well. some pretty major figures in our society at that time.
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
Martin? Thank you for your paper. You seem to always come back to this kind of what the public feel for treaty settlements, and have, has it changed much since the fiscal envelope and on to today? And I kind of agree with you that things have gotten better, but then we get that, like, Kiwi water ad in the Dawn Post, and you're kind of like, oh shit, like, are we really back at 2004? So do you think those are just kind of flashpoints, or is that really emblematic of the fact that we haven't really moved too much? It's just not that important for the media to cover anymore.
I think it's really hard to gauge, actually, how things have really, really shifted. Though there are sort of value surveys and things which do give sort of high level things about, you know, how people identify. Do you identify as a New Zealander, as your primary sort of ethnic sort of affiliation or whatever? Do you think the treaty is important or relevant? You know, though, I mean, you're getting some reasonably good results there. I think the answer to that question was around 60% that the treaty was relevant or important. But quite what that means in terms of engaging with these more fundamental issues around, I guess, a post-settlement future where iwi, hapu entities are actually playing more of a role within the body politic, and just how that interacts with the, you know, with our understandings of our past. That's what I'm trying to get at here. But there's obviously a whole heap more that could be said. Yeah.
And in Venus, with that water, I think you're referring probably to the freshwater media penguin claim and the discourse around that.
I think there's a very real claim, key politicians, not to use the particular name, claim on the fears and doubts around that, because that was a bit of a more of a gnarly one intellectually. It wasn't about a particular iwi or hapu or their claims, but it was about something that really cuts to the heart of people's sense of identity, and you know, it was about freshwater, claims on freshwater, and certain politicians played on those doubts and fears, and so I don't think that's necessarily a fair litmus test of where people's understanding is at necessarily either.
Yeah, and you tend to get the more strident views coming out too, you know, as well, when you get those sorts of issues. Yeah.
Think that I've always thought that part of the problem, the history problem that you describe, is that the Waitangi Tribunal and the Office of Pre-Settlements don't have any educative role or funding to provide any way of translating sometimes the complicated reports and historical accounts out into something that people can relate to. And it seems to me just to be such a missed opportunity for that to happen. And yeah, how much of that do you think that?
Things
you're doing that work.
If I can just say something about that particular point, I think we're starting to do it better. Like ITS, the PR releases for, you know, when each deed is signed, they're coming out on a four-pager. It's got like a one-page summary of the historical background and the basic grievances, and it describes the settlement in a reasonably nice kind of four-page brochure thing, which is online. We've got a new government website that hosts the OTS website within it, which is a lot more accessible. But I think there is an issue over the accessibility of, you know, the apology redress, the apologies in the historical accounts, because they are embedded within deeds of settlement, which are, you know, 150 plus pages, so or more. So, yeah, I think more could be done, but who's going to do it? And who's funded to do it?
that's one part of it. Because it doesn't have to be open to the tribunal to do that anyway.
No.
Do that, and I guess I have a question around not just the resources and the capacity, but actually does anybody value that work enough to make sure it gets done? Right. Is there a devaluation of tribunal history, treaty history, my understanding of the colonial past? Do we actually value that as a society? And, you know, why are we willing to tolerate the evil kids stuff? Like, we tolerate that, really, and we don't know what it's based on, what the evidence is for it. And I agree it's a bit of a gnarly And for me, it's not even necessarily about whether we land on one side of an argument or not. It's actually just being willing as citizens of Aotearoa New Zealand to be informed to a certain level of these issues, whatever side of the argument you have.
Well, I think it's partly, I was thinking in this morning's great keynote about the sort of co-production of, you know, historical knowledge aspect that, and I think it's where some of this sort of negative stuff against the treaty process is coming from, that the fact that part, you know, the majority, however you've defined that, whether it's Pākehā or whatever, sort of feel there's a sense in which they're not able to participate in the claims resolution process because it is a state iwi thing. You know, the tribunal is, the negotiations process is. So there's almost a feeling of disenfranchisement from that process. And then on the other end, we're not doing a very good job at getting the stories out once we have reached the agreements. So, yeah, I mean, I having worked in OTS and actually worked on historical accounts, you know, I really believe in their value because for a start, they're short, you know, reasonably short. So you tell the story of a group's claims in 20 to 30 pages or less. That's got to have quite a bit of value, you know, if you package that right. That's got to have a lot of value, but so yeah, we could do more work on that.
I need to jump in.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I just think we have questions at the end. Let's join.
Kia ora.